Accession number 27183, Reel 5.
Major Neave, Reel 5. When you were preparing to go over to Normandy, when the X-Room had been opened and you were being briefed, you said that there was a lot of paperwork and information coming in. Did you have a detailed briefing about the beach obstacles that you were going to encounter?
I think we were told what we were likely to encounter as obstacles and how they were all likely to be have explosive charges attached to them and all this sort of thing. But I mean, as to any detailed idea of what might be actually on the beach, we didn't have anything as detailed as that, but we were told what we might expect to find, the type of obstacles.
When you'd done your exercises, had they actually put out dummy beach obstacles as a
Not training? Very extensively, but I think they had put out a few. I mean, I think they were pretty worried that we would ever get on shore. They didn't want to make it any more difficult. Incidentally, on that, it's quite interesting. I was up in Nairn some time ago playing golf and wandered into the town and saw a very nice memorial put up to the 3rd Infantry Division and its various components for the rehearsals of D-Day. And it's a rather moving little plaque on the beach there. And we didn't land on the beach at Nairn, we landed on the beach at Berghead Bay, further to the east. But there were a lot of casualties. I say a lot of casualties, there were a number of casualties. And it was rather nice to think that the town of Nairn remembered this.
You also said that you got instruction on correct behaviour on the continent. Now, can you remember anything about that, about what advice you were given for behaving correctly once you'd left England and
Well, you know, I think it was one of those sort of pamphlets that got handed out, how not to be rude to the natives. And I think that was fairly theoretical, but I think very important that troops were told that they had to behave themselves, because I think the soldiery can get out of hand quite easily. But I don't seem to remember anything formal on a regimental level.
Were you told anything about how the French were likely to behave when you arrived? For example, were you told that you were likely to be contacted by members of the resistance with intelligence for you or other help?
Well, I think the thought there was that the immediate coastline would have been cleared of nearly all the French, and that there wouldn't be anything very much in the way of other than German soldiers to be met in the, immediately as we went in then. And I think that probably that was true. There were a few people that one came across, but one wasn't really able to do much about them or talk to them very much.
Too busy.
Too many other things to do. I dare say the troops did. I dare say the soldiers got in touch. But there weren't very many of them because they were all cleared out of the immediate coastal strip. And of course, very wisely, because all the houses and things were bombarded in a very, very intense way.
You're saying that towards the 6th of June, the squadrons are doing last-minute work on the tanks to prepare them. What sort of work would that be? Would it be
mostly waterproofing, which was a pretty tricky business. I mean, a 30-ton tank in the sea is a fairly formidable bit of equipment to make waterproof. I mean, the DD tanks themselves, that had all been done in their manufacture. I mean, apart from the canvas screen which kept them up, the actual hull of the tank was very professionally waterproof. But the wading tanks, of which there was a whole squadron and regimental headquarters, I think the final preparations were on the vehicles, where most of it would have been making sure that they were going to survive the actual passage through the water from the...
Who did that? Was it done by the crews of each vehicle?
Yes, it was done by...
Not by crews. Regimental specialists?
No, well, regimental specialists were there to advise and instruct and tell you what to do, but the actual work was done by the crews themselves.
When it came to the event, did the waterproofing work on the whole?
On the whole, it did. On the whole, it did. Proof of that could be said that the actual tank, the colonel's tank, which was known as Balaclava.
The one you were in?
The one I was in. went all the way from, well, Fort George, before Fort George. I remember it was delivered to us near Dumfries at a place called Hoddam Castle. We then went on up to Inverness, and it survived until the final war was over at Bremerhaven.
A very lucky tank.
A very lucky tank. And it had been come through the wading process of coming off the LCT through about 8 foot of water and into onto the shore. And it's also a very good indication of the reliability of the diesel Sherman tanks. They simply went on and on. It had probably had three or four new sets of tracks, and probably had at least one or two new engines. But I mean, it was basically the same tank.
It's often said that one of the weaknesses of the Sherman was the transmission. Did you find the transmission required a lot of attention?
I think we were probably lucky. I don't remember that. I don't remember that being a problem.
You mentioned in the diary the communications are very complex, that you had 101 wireless sets, and that you carried out netting by wavometer. What was the wavometer, and how would that work?
I honestly don't remember, and can't really recollect what that in fact meant. The signals officer was a very busy chap, and it was a very vital job to get the regimental net working, because the sets, of course, were nothing like as sophisticated, reliable and good as they would have been today. And I mean, it was quite a problem to make sure that everyone was, as we called it, on net. I don't know whether that is something that happens now or not, but if you weren't and you couldn't communicate by wireless, you were in a pretty good muddle.
Did you have a regimental net as such, or did you have subsidiary squadron nets below regimental level?
We had all sorts. We had squadron nets and regimental nets and ancillary nets for the other people, the different services, get home the LAD and that sort of thing, and the medical people. And no, it was very, very complicated. The signals officer was a very, had a hell of a job, I think. And he probably had to work all night, too, to get these things sorted out. And as I say, the sets were not, frankly, reliable. They weren't, sort of spot-on things that we have now.
Did you do most of the radio talking on your in your tank?
Yes,
in the
most,
tank?
Yeah, most of it was the command tank, the command net was the command net, and the rear link, the second in command was the chap who had the rear link, but then there was quite a lot of talk on the rear link from the command tank as well. And of course, the thing was also complicated by the fact that we never, or I say never, virtually never operated as a regiment. It was nearly always a squadron attached to a battalion of infantry under whose command they operated. And the colonel was really not doing a cohesive operation of three squadrons working in to one objective, except on very, very unusual and rare occasions. We're nearly always supporting a battalion of infantry, squadron supporting a battalion of infantry.
Did you ever get the idea that this was really a misuse of the Sherman, because it had been designed as a battle tank and an exploitation tank, hadn't it, rather than for close support, which was more the role for the Churchills?
Well, I don't think it ever, when you realise the sort of close country we were working in, it wasn't tank country. And I think the role of the tank was misunderstood constantly in the campaign. And trying to either work in attacking across open country, which took place in that dreadful Battle of Goodwood, was just as misuse of tanks, in my opinion, as it was trying to support infantry in very close country, where you could be bazookaed from. It was, but I don't think the fact the Sherman, whether it was a Sherman or a Churchill, didn't make much difference, I don't think. The thing about the Sherman was it kept going, and it could go on and on. It wasn't very fast, it was pretty slow, but it was very reliable mechanically. It was not very heavily armoured, so it was penetrated very easily by the German armament. And it wasn't very fast, but it kept going.
The other thing about the Sherman, of course, was there were lots of them.
And there were lots of them, yes.
Did you ever run short of replacements during
the
time?
Oh, yes, we did. And because on the assault, we lost quite a few. Not as many as we were expected to lose, but we did lose quite a few. And it took a day or two to top that lot up.
When you were briefed just before going into action, that would probably have been round about the 3rd, I think, 3rd of June, you were briefed on bogus maps with, presumably the terrain was accurate, but the place names were changed.
I think so. I think so. I can't really remember quite.
Do you remember if you actually had any suspicion of where you were likely to be going?
No.
You didn't?
No. I mean, I think one had a broad idea that it was not going to be Calais, and it was not going to be out to Brittany.
Yes.
But whether it was Le Havre, Dieppe, or Le Touquet, I don't think.
So it's quite a long stretch of coast that you thought
yes.
was a nightmare.
I think probably people had a shrewd idea.
What effect did the postponement of the operation have? You mentioned that on the 4th you were loaded up, and then you heard that the operation was going to be postponed.
Difficult now to remember. I think one only had limited rations, one very limited space. It was extremely uncomfortable. I mean, there was nowhere to lie down, let alone there was nowhere to sit down on these LCTs. We were kept on them. And I think the attitude really was one of frustration and discomfort, and rather than anything else, perhaps a little bit of relief that you weren't going to face up to the shooting quite so soon. But I think basically we were frustrated. We wanted to get on with it.
Did you get any explanation about why the postponement?
Oh, the weather.
Yes.
The weather was quite clearly it was the weather, and particularly with the DD tanks, which are the most unseaworthy things. It was far too rough to operate with them.
You also mentioned that there seemed to be a great concentration of interest on D-Day itself. And no one had really taken much interest in what was going to happen after D-Day. There hadn't been much speculation or interest in going inland.
No, I think that's rather interesting. I hadn't thought of that until now. But I think that is probably true. It was so vital, the actual gaining a foothold and getting into the initial objectives. They were all quite clear. I mean, each squadron, each bit of the lot who went in had a quite distinct objective to achieve. And that, I think, was... But what would happen that night and the following day, I don't think anybody had given, on a regimental level or a squadron level, too much thought about.
So that all the interest was on the first job, as it were.
Getting there and getting a foothold and
yes.
Making sure we were there.
So in the plan for assault, I think you had B squadron to the East Yorkshires and A squadron to the South Lancashires.
Mm-hmm.
Had you trained with those
battalions? Yes, we had. We'd done that up in Fort George.
Were they identical in the way in which they went about doing things in their tactical
procedures?
Oh,
I think so.
I
think they were highly professional and very splendid.
And was there any difference that you could discern between the character of the men in the two different regiments? Because the strength of the regimental system is supposed to be that every regiment has its own customs and character and outlook and
Ethos,
yes.
I think basically the squadrons got on very well with the people they were working with, and I think I don't think there was any particular distinction that was made between the. No, I don't think I wouldn't have been aware of any.
Perhaps they were.
It was a very good relationship, I remember.
Well, I would expect that if you'd been training together, you would have established a very good working relationship with the battalions. But it's interesting that you'd got a battalion of Yorkshiremen next to a battalion of Lancastrians.
Yes.
Perhaps they were trying to encourage them to do well by promoting rivalry. I think one of the things that's mentioned is that the squadrons were trained to carry out battle drills with the infantry for attacking beach defences. Had they trained with Averys as well for attacks on pillboxes and bunkers?
Yes, they had.
I mean, was there a set way of approaching and taking on a pillbox?
I don't remember that there was. I think the terrain was the great dictator of the immediate tactics, mm-hmm. and until they can see the what they're up against. But I think they had theories were very much put into practice and practiced again. And of course, they had not only the Avrys but the flails too. And
they were mine clearing, weren't they?
Mine clearing.
Did those land about the same time as the DD tanks, or did they
come
later?
No, a little bit after.
Later?
I mean, 10 minutes, quarter of an hour afterwards.
I think, as far as I remember, I don't.
My memory is terribly sort of sketchy now. About
I mean, do you remember if you suffered any particular delay or loss due to mines on the beach itself? Or
there were quite a lot of people blown up, tanks. But I don't
think we had too many actual casualties, personnel casualties from mines.
It would have been tracks being blown off.
Tracks being blown off, creating congestion and having to be towed out of the way. That was the great problem, was congestion.
Did the LAD land early? Did it land shortly after the first
wave? No, not all that early. It didn't. I should think it was about 40 minutes or something like that later.
Yeah, well, you can build up quite a lot of congestion in 40 minutes.
Exactly.
And I mean, I think they had to be pushed out of the way by going tanks.
Yeah. Or just barging them onto the
barging outside. Them out of the light. Yeah. And getting. My brother had quite a lot of trouble getting it, clearing the exits, I remember.
Yes. You met him, didn't you, on the beach?
Met him on the beach, which was a remarkable instance. I was sitting in my tank and I suddenly saw his head peer over the top. And he kept bobbing down as mortar shells came over to get out of the way.
What did he say to you? Do you remember what his...
No, I mean, I think he was hello and sort of greeting him, how are you getting on and what's happening, and... It was a rather futile conversation, but
it was rather relevant too,
because I mean, he was a very vital part of the. I think he'd been about
the first person to arrive on the beach.
Yes.
And the great thing was to clear the exits from the
battles that got mined and push them out of the way and get on. And this is. What he was, I think, we were talking about how that was going, because we all had to get off the same beach and the same way out.
Yes, the important thing with a beach landing is to get onto the beach safely, across it and off it, as quickly as you can.
Exactly.
Did you have detailed information about the enemy and enemy defence works?
A tremendous amount of information about them. The bunkers. They were all named after motor cars, Hillman, Daimler and a few others. Yeah. And they were very heavily defended, and they were a major objective. Mm. And once...
off the beach, that was the objective. Those, at that range, the objectives were very clear, and the objects were very precise.
Did the information prove to be accurate? Because I know later on you went and visited a headquarters in Daimler, didn't
yes.
you? Did you find that the intelligence had been
correct?
I think
it was pretty good. It was pretty good. They were very fiercely defended. But I think that was really pretty. We had pretty good information there.
Had those defences been destroyed to any extent or suppressed by the support you were getting from the Navy and the Air Force?
I think they'd been made them keep their heads down very much. Mm. Whether they'd actually done very much physical damage, they were very strong, they were very heavily built, and I mean it would have needed a direct hit by a very big bomb to get rid of it. Mm. But I think it's the bombardment undoubtedly made them keep their heads down very effectively.
Did they open fire as soon as you approached the breach or arrived, or were they still suppressed by
shock. It took a bit of time for them to get, and then they had mortar shells were one of the big problems
coming down on the beach.
Well, that would be very bad for the infantry. Presumably, you were reasonably well protected.
Reasonably well protected from mortars, yes. Reasonably well.
Well, there is always the risk of one coming in through the hatch, but that's rather remote, isn't it?
Fairly remote. It happened. It did happen.
Mm.
Killed the mess sergeant, and he got killed by mortar shell night later on in the battle. It was very sad.
One of the key members of the regiment.
Yes,
the mess sergeant was very much keen.
And you mentioned that over to the left was Le Havre, which was very heavily fortified. Were you aware of the defences of Le Havre firing?
Funny enough, I could see them.
Yes.
And that picture, which I think you've probably seen, of the regimental landing, you can see on the left of the picture the Havre,
the gunfire there. But I mean, we weren't aware of it actually being aimed at us. I couldn't tell that.
No, I mean, they'd have been just blanketing the area from that range, wouldn't they?
Or, I think, more concentrating on the seaward, on the ships.
So presumably there was a bombardment and a counter-bombardment going on with the
Havre. Yes. I don't think there was a great deal of bombardment from the front, as it were, on the sea. Mm. There were some, but I think mostly it was some big heavy stuff from the Havre, probably.
Yes. Well, that would have been more effective because they had in effect been, they would have been enfilading
it. Yes. Well, that was a long way off.
Mm.
It was a long way off.
Yes, that would be what, 10, 12 miles?
Yeah, I think at least.
Something like that.
At least. Mm. I remember very much seeing a Norwegian destroyer hit a mine, and it was nose right up in the air, straight in the water. I think that was a mine, not a shell.
Did you see any other ships suffering damage from?
Oh yes, there were a lot of lame ducks sort of wandering about.
Was there any enemy degree of resistance? Do you think it was roughly about the level you'd anticipated, or was it stronger or weaker than you'd been led to expect by the training and briefing?
I think it's very difficult to... I think possibly it was less... The opposition was less than one had... I think one had imagined hundreds of people running about on the beach sort of hand-to-hand battle, which of course it was never going to be. But I think that's purely one's own personal imagination.
When did you first see your first German then? Let's say you'd arrived on the beach. And
I don't think I saw one until we were driving off the beach, a couple of dead ones on the road leading into the beach.
What about live ones?
Well, I'd seen people running about, difficult to tell whether they were Germans. I think they probably were German. I think one probably had seen them round these great pillboxes.
And POWs presumably coming in?
Well, not at that stage, because there was nothing one could do with them. But very shortly, as soon as we got off the beach, there was a POW question, and they were
sent back to the beach, by which time
one was... I wasn't there. I didn't know what they did with them.
You were pushing inland, presumably.
Yes.
What impression did they make on you when you saw them? Did you get any impression of their physical condition and their demeanor?
Pretty shaken, but physical condition was all right. And,
You mentioned that you were pretty well on your own for a long while because the CO and the 2IC were off accompanying squadrons.
Mm.
Did they actually rally onto the RHQ?